The title of this talk is, If It's In The News, It Must Be True. Just let me explain. I am a BBC political correspondent. I've actually written a novel as well, which I think someone's going to refer to later, but I'm speaking about news values. Is news just creative writing? There's always a joke in newsrooms when every single newsroom I've ever been in, I've heard this joke. One journalist is doing his expenses. Another one walks past and says, hello, John, doing a bit of creative writing, are you? The same joke again and again. There was the Sun reporter who went to the Gulf War and he was struggling around, casting around, trying to find things to write on his expenses form. And while he was on the plane coming back, he wrote £87 in the column where the amounts were put. And he looked for something to put in the other column, the description of the item that he'd spent it on. And he copied some Arabic words off the back of a folder in the back of the seat in front of him. Now, what he didn't realize was that News International have some very sharp accountants now. And he got a call a couple of weeks later saying, this item you paid £87 for says in Arabic something that translates as, in the event of turbulence, fasten your safety belt. So is the rest of the news just an exercise in creative writing? Well, some things certainly are. The Guardian the other day did a piece on Michael Portillo. It was Hugo Young, their columnist, and I was reading it, and he said this sentence in the middle that struck me rather hard. He said, Michael Portillo is a con man of a different order of seriousness from any of his colleagues. I thought that's pretty sharp, but it's probably true. Next day in the paper, there was an apology. It said, we apologize to Hugo Young and Michael Portillo. What the piece should have said was, Michael Portillo is in command of a different order of seriousness from any of his colleagues. Now, I mean, if you can reverse a statement and it appears equally true, you've got a serious problem. So it's worth saying there's a difference between comment and news. That was comment. Let's talk about news. Last week, there happened to be someone who surfaced suddenly in our office, this is always very alarming, as a Conservative Party member. He came up to me and he said, you might be interested in this. I've been sent this document through the post as a Conservative Party member. It's a questionnaire asking my views. What do I believe on sound inflation, defense, immigration, education, etc. And I said, okay, yeah, well, let me have a look at that. I'd be quite interested in that. And with this questionnaire was a document, and it said, this document is the views of 100 Conservative Party members. And it was 4 pages long, and it was, generally speaking, fairly mundane. You know, he said, we believe in low inflation, we believe in people being educated properly, we believe in not being invaded, things like that. But there were just a couple of things that caught my eye. One was it says, we believe there should be no more defense cuts. And it said there should be a moral basis to education. And I looked at this document here, and I thought, well, there's probably a story here for two reasons. First of all, this is a questionnaire that's new. It hasn't happened before. And secondly, this document that they gave alongside it with these views of Conservative Party members is asking for at least two policies which are slightly to the right of where the government now is. And we invited in the woman who'd been putting out this document, sending it to people. And I said to her, look, this is new, isn't it? You haven't done a questionnaire before. She said, well, that's nonsense. Okay, this is the first questionnaire we've ever done. But we're always asking for the views of members. That's the first thing. And secondly, I said, well, your statements in this backup document that you've got, they're slightly right-wing, aren't they? And she said, well, no, that's nonsense as well. These are just the views of ordinary party members. So I said, thank you very much. I shook her by the hand. She went home. And the next day, we splashed it all over the air. Conservative Party consults its members on a shift to the right. That was my interpretation of it. And the basis was, one, they've never sent out a questionnaire before. And two, this backup document had right-wing views that were slightly to the right of the government's present position. The following morning, the same morning after it had been out, the Evening Standard splashed it on its front page. Conservatives consulted this time on back to basics. So the whole thing was beginning to spiral completely out of control. And I saw the woman, unfortunately, that same evening. And she pointed her finger at me and she said, there have been, since we last spoke, Jeremy, I have sent 5 letters of complaint about you to the BBC. Because I told you that it was the It wasn't the first time we'd sent any questionnaires, and I told you it wasn't a shift to the right. And I said, I'm a political correspondent, and I stand by every word. And the next morning, vindicating me, you might think, all the broadsheets had the same thing. Conservatives consulted on shift to the right. Now, my question is, who was right? Was I wrong? Was she wrong? It's very difficult to say. It's all in the interpretation. And frankly, she could come and do a talk after me and convince you that I'm the worst political correspondent in the BBC, perhaps even in the country. But I don't think I am. I was walking across Westminster Hall a couple of days ago with a colleague, another political correspondent. Just got to say hello to a friend. Brian, hi. How are you doing? It's a friend from university, sorry. I was walking across Westminster Hall with a colleague the other day, and I said to him, listen, John, do you believe in anything? That was my slight, you know, attempt to subtly bring up Christianity. And he was a bit staggered and offended, and he said, I believe in the pursuit of truth. Which was his attempt to bring up journalism, I suppose. And my deduction from that is, just leaving that point alone as it stands there, that no matter how topsy-turvy things do seem coming out of your TVs and radios, there are some people in the system who are actually committed to bringing you a form of reality. The trouble is, you may think, and I may agree with you, that there are some biases in our news system that can stop that happening. Let me talk about those biases for a moment. Bias number one, we are selling a product. If news is boring, and often that means it's good news, it doesn't get told. So the only type of news you'll ever hear is exciting news, which often means that it's bad. The thing about selling a product has very striking effects. I was sent down about 6 or 7 months ago to Southend to hear a speech by Mrs. Thatcher. It was when John Major was in a very, very difficult way, and everything she was saying was being focused on. And as a result, she did this speech in private, and all the journalists were kept in the rain outside. And the first thing we knew about the actual thing having ended was that this chap traipsed out in a dinner jacket at about 11 o'clock, a sort of rather drunken manner, and said, Britain is the greatest country in the world! So we thought the speech must be over. Someone shouted at him, excuse me, sir, can you tell us your name? And he said, that's off the record. So afterwards, she'd gone, all her security people, seems to have more than Mr. Major, incidentally, when she goes out and does speeches. And we went in to try and sweep up all the people and to find out exactly what she'd said in case there was a news line there. And we were going around. And after about 15 minutes, it really was rather boring. She was doing the thing about strong defense and low inflation and education and so on and so forth. And I wasn't then picking up the feeling that this was a conservative canvas on shift to the right or anything like that. I was really pretty bored with it. And I went home and all the other journalists went home. And we woke up the next morning and there was the front page headline on the Sun. Thatcher says, Granny will always be there. And the Sun reporter had got the story. We'd all missed it. She'd apparently just dropped this in somewhere through the speech. Now, that's an example where we're selling a product, and he sold his product, and we didn't, so we failed. But it can catch you out as well, and sometimes truth can be a victim. There was a party at 10 Downing Street where a number of journalists were present, and one journalist, who is slightly deaf, thought that he heard John Major saying, I'm going to crucify my bastards. Now, for various reasons, that is not what he said. You'll just have to take my word for it. He didn't say that, but he'd made this reference to bastards already, the famous right-wingers in his cabinet, Michael Portillo, Peter Lilly, Michael Howard, etc. And this journalist thought he'd said that, and he came outside this party, and he was at a bus stop, of all things, and he saw this Sun reporter there. She was the same one who did the granny story. And he said, you'll never guess what I've just heard. Major's just been in there ranting, saying, I'm going to crucify my bastards. And of course, he never assumed that when he woke up the next morning, this would be the front page on the Sun. Major says, I will crucify my bastards. Now, the moral of that is, and as I say, that story was wrong, but the drive to sell the product will sometimes just steamroller the truth completely. There's a second thing here, bias number two, and it feeds very nicely off that point. News creates news. Because in that instance, the very fact of the story having been written, even though it wasn't true, created an awful lot of reaction to it. People started reacting to the untrue story, and their reaction became true and became the news. We've recently seen the Diana story, for example, this police phone pest claims. I haven't ever had a call from Diana, I'm bound to say. I don't think I have. Anyway, someone phoned me once and didn't say anything, so maybe that was her. I don't know. But but she made the mistake of deciding to go to a newspaper about it. And she rang up a friend of the Daily Mail. And I don't know, what, maybe someone was intercepting her call. I don't know. People seem to intercept everybody's calls at the moment. And someone phoned up a photographer and said she's meeting the Daily Mail in this square in London. This photographer said, I can't make it, I'm in Epping or something. So he phoned up a friend of his. And then the result was that Diana, talking to this journalist in her car in the square in London, became the story. And people started doing profiles of the journalist involved. The point there is that not only does news create news, but often journalists become part of the news. By the very act of being there, they distort the story they're covering. When US troops landed in Somalia, there were shots, famous shots of them running along crouched as though they were all going to be hit by gunfire. Very exciting. Until you saw the photographs that went with them, which showed these American TV cameramen happily running alongside in Bermuda shorts, asking them to do some bits again. I was started off my journalistic career after I was at Durham University with Brian over there. Hi, Brian. I haven't seen him since I left. I've heard about you, though, Brian. No. I was working on the Coventry Evening Telegraph. It's steady. there was one, I mean, I could honestly do an hour's talk on Coventry, but I didn't want to do that. But there was one incident where we'd all been to a party, and some of these journalists went back in a car, all crashed into a car, you know, and they saw a fire engine outside a house. And they thought, we'd better go and investigate, because that's what you do when you're on a regional paper. So they pulled outside, and they had a look, and they couldn't see anything, and someone walked up and said, oh, there's nothing here for you lads, and so on. And so they drove off home. And the next day, another journalist was in the newsroom, and he was doing the thing of ringing round the fire brigade and the police and the hospitals and so on to see what was happening. And the fire brigade said, well, we've got quite an interesting story for you. There was a fire at a house in Wood End. We think it was arson. And we saw six men in a car speeding away from the scene. So before anyone had realised, the headline in the paper was, fire suspects were packed into speeding mini. So by the very act of being there, the journalist can distort the news. Bias number three, is that news is picture-led. There is no doubt about this at all. So are our lives, after all. I mean, we function so much on vision. If John Major comes smiling out of number 10 on a very bad day, we have to say, as TV reporters, John Major smiling despite ... because he's controlled us by smiling. Barclays' profit announcements were wrecked by the guy who hired a poster site and strung himself up from it, saying, Barclays has left me hanging out to dry. If you think of the great news stories of the age, you'll notice a very interesting point that connects them all. Let me list some. The Challenger disaster. Remember that? 1986? The assassination of John F. Kennedy. The moon landing, the O.J. Simpson car chase, which of course is bigger than all the other ones, the ice skating wars between Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan, the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan, the James Bulger abduction, captured on video, of course, the L.A. riots, the storming of the Russian White House. Now, you notice that all those stories have something in common. They are all physical events. You do not see anywhere on that list someone having an idea live on TV or some moment when an important truth was communicated. No, we are in a picture age and news has become physical because it's picture-led. In TV, a story with good pictures will get priority over a story with bad pictures, boring pictures, or no pictures. The Sun's famous... I'm sorry to keep mentioning The Sun. I once go into terrible... I wrote a column for Third Way. I got into terrible trouble because I said The Sun is a fabulous newspaper. And perhaps the people not laughing were the ones who wrote the letters of complaint. I don't know. But in the Sun, they had this front page lead, revealed the Beast of Exmoor, supposed to be this beast that was going around killing people, you know, a 6 feet long puma, they said. And they printed this thing and it was striking. And believe you me, well, you know, I had it off the stand quicker than any of the broadsheet papers that day and was looking at it. And then someone said, look, there's a cow on the edge of this picture. And if that beast that you've shown is 6 foot long, the cow is 19 feet long. And it turned out to be a cat. But the fact is that the fact is that it was a picture and it drew your attention in instantly. Never mind about the content. When Michael Heseltine was ill, he made a classic mistake, and he doesn't make very many of them, but he allowed himself to be photographed going between, you'll remember this, the van, the hospital ambulance, and a helicopter. And there was this picture, and really quite a symbolic picture, a hugely powerful and important politician reduced to hobbling along in a dressing gown, showing his legs, and sort of bumping along into this helicopter. And what had happened there was the press photographers, who are, believe you me, a breed all of their own. They're an extraordinary breed of people. They had just been flooded Venice, where he was, decided this is probably where he's going to turn up. This is where he's going to get out of the van. They'd all got their ladders up there. And what they did was that this is the word they used. They monstered him. That's the word they use. If someone ever says you've just been monstered, you'll know your pictures are appearing in the papers the next day. But that was a very powerful image. And it will always be connected with Heseltine in our minds. It's funny how powerful the picture can be. That's bias number three. Bias number four, I think, is that the news media, and this is probably, I hate to shoot myself in the foot, especially true of short broadcast pieces, are not really equipped to communicate anything very subtle. I wonder if you know from which novel this first line is taken. My father's being Pirip, and my Christian name Philip. My infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip. Thank you very much. Great Expectation. Now, you may have great expectations of the news, but the fact is that to an extent, the news process works a bit like that child's brain. It cannot distinguish, I don't think, between subtleties. There are no Philips, no Pirips, just Pips. I'm not talking about panorama here. I'm talking about the day-to-day sloosh of events that comes out of the tube. Someone comes in, they say, right, Sir Jeremy, my name is John Bates. I want you to describe me, please, as the assistant controller of the plastics division of Plessy PLC. It's very important, he says. It's a lot of political significance internal. It has to be that title. He looks at the TV that night. He's up, John Bates, Plessy. Cannot communicate subtlety. I once tried to explain the mechanics of something to do with petrol stations in a radio piece. I thought I was being very analytical. Someone said, Jeremy, that piece was no good. You just made too much of a mouthful of it. Everything has to be reduced. Do you remember that time John Major was in difficulties? Remember when John Major was in crisis? He's in a crisis the whole time. If I said you remember when he wasn't in difficulties, that would probably isolate it a bit better. But that's another story. but he was at this dinner, and he made classic error number one of news presentation, which was to put his head in his hands. He actually was thinking up a poem, but he sat there with his head like that. And of course, everyone monstered him at that moment. And the headlines the next day, with this huge photo across all the Sunday papers, were John Major in terminal crisis. It should have said John Major in poetry crisis, because he was making up a poem, and believe you me, it was appalling. There was that incident on Question Time when Kenneth Clark was jokingly asked, if the Scott inquiry goes against you, will you resign? He said, no, I won't resign. I don't believe in resigning. I put the taxes on. Well, yeah, I might resign if it goes against me. Why not? And the next day, the headline was, Ken Clark will resign if Scott Inquiry goes against him. Similarly, do you remember John Tunstall? And there's a question for anyone interested in current affairs. Who is John Tunstall? He's the head of the Australian delegation to the Commonwealth Games. Right, right. Who said, talking about the fact that there were 38 disabled people among 1,000 able-bodied competitors, it's embarrassing for them and it's embarrassing for the rest of the athletes. Talking about visually impaired bowls and swimming and so on. Now, some people here might privately admit to a a sliver of sympathy for something of what he was saying, he said, phrasing it extremely carefully, in the sense that he... But on TV, you see, I'm running into the same difficulty that he had, because it's impossible to communicate it subtly. But on TV, it just translates very simply, this is embarrassing, and he was run out of town. And one would say, rightly so. I wish I'd written that bit down. I just had John Tunstall written down. Moving on. Politicians use the lack of subtlety. They're very good at it. And we need to be, as consumers of the TV news media, aware of this. Ronald Reagan was not a very subtle person. That was ideal. He just made a lot of jokes and waved. One of his best jokes was when he said, you know, Jimmy Carter flew on a mission to Iran and got shot at twice, once over Denver. His approach suited the TV age to a T, and that may be its greatest indictment. Colleague of Gordon Brown said to me privately, you know, Gordon can't become Labour leader because of his left eye. I'd never noticed his left eye, but apparently this is some major political handicap or something. You know, his left eye is strained. I kept looking at it. You know, I never saw anything wrong with it. But there was no sense of self, you know, so no sense of humour in what he said. He was making a serious point. Those are my four biases. As a Christian, I admit that I am slightly uncertain about a process in which you take truth and you do something to it, and we definitely do something to it before we pass it on. I suppose in a way we all do that when we tell stories of our faith as Christians, how we became Christians. We do package them, we pass them on, perhaps we package everything before we pass it on. But I'm always uncertain about the relationship between the truth I was originally told and the truth I'm then telling other people. We interview people for 10 minutes, we use 10 seconds, without shame. No apology necessary. I've been on the receiving end of this myself. I was in Yugoslavia, and I'm not not a war correspondent at all. That's the problem, actually, because I drove down this road. Someone said, you know, if you want to get to this town, the quickest way is across this field. You know, I didn't happen to ask, you know, will I get killed? and I drove across this field with three or four other blokes, press photographers, which is another fatal thing to do. And there's this shooting, and someone, we got ambushed. And there was this guy with an automatic weapon shooting through the corn at us. And they said, jump out. I said, no, go on. Anyway, we stopped the car, we jumped out, and we had to lie in this ditch. And I had my tape recorder, so I started running it, of course. And I said, I'm being shot at, I'm going to die, or something like that. I edited that bit out. I cut that bit out, but it was very nasty. I mean... It really was. And we lay down in this ditch, and there was one guy who was obviously quite excited by the fact that I had never done this before. And he sat there, sat up deliberately a bit higher than me, and said, has anyone got any fly spray? But these shots were coming over, and then they started shooting mortar bombs. And I honestly thought I was going to die. One exploded about 20 yards to the left with a very loud bang. And the next thing that happened was a bullet passed just over my head, about a foot away. And I'll never forget the sound. It went pew, like that. You actually heard it cutting the air. And I was recording all this saying, you know, this, I was trying to give the overview, you know. Meanwhile, in another part of Yugoslavia, but no. And I got back to the hotel and I put it together what I thought was going to be the most exciting piece they had ever heard on the Today program, because at the time I was a reporter for the Today program. It was about 7 minutes long. And I sent it down to them, and the next morning I phoned up and they said, yeah, thanks for that piece this morning, Jeremy. We had to cut it to 3 minutes because of the travel news. I thought, why did I bother? Nevertheless, it seems to me, if the journalist has integrity, it says here, if he's like the colleague I mentioned who said, rather heartwarmingly, I believe in the pursuit of truth, it seems to me you might be able to apply the maxim that truth is often eclipsed, but never extinguished. The only trouble is the power of the media is... immense. I'm always amazed at it. A friend of mine came round to visit Westminster, the news operation that we have at Parliament, and it is quite a fascinating sort of setup. And what happens is often politicians come in and they talk from what's called a remote studio into Newsnight or wherever, and they sit there and we project Westminster behind them. It's a projection. It's not the real thing. It's filmed. In fact, often it's filmed earlier. It comes out of an electronic picture store. And we asked for a demonstration of this thing, and he was flicking it around, showing us how he could change the different times of day. And Malcolm Rifkin was sitting in there, and as Malcolm Rifkin sat there, the thing was changing behind him, you know. And he said, you see Malcolm sitting there, he's in the daytime, now he's in the nighttime, and so on. And Malcolm Rifkin didn't know what was going on. But what this technician didn't quite appreciate was that any second now, Malcolm Rifkin was going to go live into Newsnight. And this indeed happened, and just in the corner of the room on another screen was the Newsnight output, the program as the viewers were seeing it. And I was watching it down there as my friend was being demonstrated this equipment. And he said, see, day, night, and I and I just said, that I think you better stop that, because he's on the air. And this guy, we took him away on a stretcher, but that's how powerful it is. You can almost change night to day and day to night. But it helps, perhaps, that we're not serving the politicians. We're serving the viewers. Similarly, the politicians complain like crazy when they feel they've been misrepresented. So perhaps rather than doling out a series of untruths, we're in this rather taut relationship where people are pulling us from either side and we're being stretched into a kind of honesty. Peddling untruths, after all, is not profitable. Look at the Sunday Sport. More untruths in that paper than any other, less sales than any other national paper. Spitfire found on moon, they told us. Alien turned my wife into a coffee table. Elvis lives. Not a big circulation paper. What's a Christian doing in the media? I don't know. I don't think I'm setting a Christian agenda. People always are asking me for sort of favors and saying, you know, can you, there's a march going on in a borough southwest of Swindon. We're marching for our church and everyone, you know, at least 30 people are going to be on it. Please, can you get the news cameras down there? Someone, that one sometimes gets lost in the diary. I don't think I'm setting a Christian agenda particularly, because that's not possible. There's a huge checks and balances system, but I'm not setting a non-Christian agenda. Perhaps the truth is that I enjoy it, and I think it's important to be there. It would be terrible if there weren't any Christians doing it. But the truth as it comes out of your TV and radio screens, radio screen, yeah, well, that'll be a development, is rather like Bertrand Russell's coffee table. Remember he said that in his book about philosophy, I'm just rounding off here, it's rather like the coffee table, as I move around it, it changes shape. So it cannot be the coffee table, because the coffee table, I am certain, is constant in shape. I don't know how he was certain of that. That's always been my problem with what he said. But anyway, he said, the coffee table changes shape as I move around it. It can't be the coffee table, because I know the coffee table is constant in shape. Well, it's unlike Christian news, Christian truth in that respect, the news that you hear on the radio and see on TV, because Christian truth doesn't change shape, and that's the key difference, I think, between the kind of thing that you're told from journalists and the kind of thing that you're told from the Bible and from your own spiritual experience. But the fact is, perhaps as you watch this rather confusing and untrustworthy shifting image on your TV screen, listen to it on the radio, read about it in the newspapers, you can work out behind it what shape the coffee table actually is. And therefore, my argument this morning as I round up is that perhaps the media give you just about enough representation of the truth for you to work out what's happening on the other side of it. As Oscar Wilde wrote in A Woman of No Importance, do you believe all that is written in the newspapers? I do. Nowadays, it is only the unreadable that occurs. Thank you very much. Thanks.